Good morning. I'd like to add my welcome to those that have already been spoken. Normally when I stand here, it's to give an update on our partner BMS missionaries who are working in Mozambique under BMS's justice stream. And that sets some of the context for what I'm going to say this morning. When Tony Blair's government introduced the bill that was to become the Human Rights Act, it said it wanted to bring rights home. And this morning, we're going to bring justice home and talk about how God's instruction to administer justice every morning might apply to us. And to do that, I want to tell you a little about the background of this chapter in Jeremiah. I'm going to attempt to place it in its historical context. And I'm going to demonstrate, I hope, how that context reinforces the message. None of us likes being taken out of context, and yet it's something we can all be guilty of at one time or another. When we focus solely on what a person has done and assume their worst motivations instead of asking them what their reasons were, perhaps. An aside, passing comment, taken out of context from a more nuanced argument can make a person's argument seem more edgy, controversial, or hostile. It's one reason why politicians are so careful what they say to the media. And it can happen when we read the Bible. We're aware that it's possible to take passages of scripture, even single verses, and give them undue prominence, leading to controversy, condemnation, and unhelpful distraction. Perhaps you've read a particularly black and white verse in the Bible and wondered about your own position before God. Or looking at the wider context of the passage and its historical setting will give a more nuanced message, and I dare to suggest a more accurate representation of God. So I'd want to argue that whenever we study a verse of scripture, we should always have in mind the literary and the historical context. What we tend to find is that where a verse indeed does mean what it says and says what it means, the context will support that. We've lost nothing by the contextual exercise, probably learnt something as well. Sometimes the context will show that the verse came about in very specific circumstances. You might reasonably ask how it might apply in other circumstances and times. And sometimes the context not only support what the text appears to say, it will reinforce it. And I think that's the situation in Jeremiah 21. With this phrase, administer justice every morning. While that phrase can indeed stand alone, in context, its impact is much greater. The book of Jeremiah is not necessarily straightforward to understand. Our natural assumption when we read something, the Bible or anything else, is to assume that it follows a linear chronology. What we find is that the material in the book of Jeremiah is very often not in chronological order. And that has implications for us being able to place it in its true context. But chapter 21, expressly tells us that it's in the time of Zedekiah. And we know from the book of Kings that Zedekiah was the last king of Judah before the Babylonian invasion and the exile of the people to Babylon. Jeremiah's ministry took place roughly between 627 BC and 585 and covered the reigns of King Josiah and several of his sons. This is about 100 years after Assyria had brought an end to the northern kingdom of Israel. So we're talking about the remnants of God's people that Judah signified. Shalom, who's also known as Jehoahaz, was the first son of Josiah, and he ruled in 609 BC for about 3 months, and we find that towards the end of 2 Kings. The monarchy then passed to his brother Jehoiakim for about 11 years, and then to his brother Jeconiah for another 3 months. And then finally, it went to Zedekiah for another 11 years until the Babylonian invasion. So Jeremiah 21 records incidents that took place around 586 BC. What was Jeremiah's message? Well, consistently throughout the book of Jeremiah, we find him railing against Josiah's successors for the idolatry that's being practiced in Judah. Every oracle given from God mentions this. But idolatry can manifest itself in many ways, including injustice. Injustice is mentioned a few times in Jeremiah, but it comes to a head in this statement in Jeremiah 21. So while Jeremiah is not written chronologically, if we did place Jeremiah's message into its chronological order, this chapter, from the time of Zedekiah, would be close to the end, with the culmination of the prophet's warnings to the final series of Judah's kings arriving with the final invasion, the siege of Jerusalem, and the exile brought by Nebuchadnezzar's army. And it's in these last embers of the nation of Judah, brought to an end by its idolatry and injustice, with the enemy approaching and even surrounding the city, that Jeremiah reminds the king that he must administer justice every morning. So if we read those words in isolation, we could certainly derive a principle that God has a general desire for the king, for the state, to administer justice. But that might leave it open to us to ask whether there were any exceptions to that rule. Any circumstances when the command to administer justice would be limited or suspended. As a rule, I would want to argue that where the circumstances differ, rules and the application of rules must also differ. But what we find in Jeremiah 21 is that the context not only supports the general meaning of the words, but it fortifies them in several ways. It removes any escape route from around them. If imminent invasion and exile does not provide an exception to the command to administer justice, well, then I suggest there is never a time when it's not God's command to administer justice. Secondly, the sin of practicing injustice in Jeremiah and in this chapter is placed on a level of seriousness with that of idolatry. So injustice is considered exceptionally seriously by God. And third, even if you're a very small nation or group of people, God requires you to practice justice. Judah was just one of the original 12 tribes of Israel. It was held to the same standards that God required of the whole nation. And finally, we look back to what Jeremiah says at the start of that chapter. The situation is truly hopeless. Even practicing justice now by obeying God doesn't sound like it would prevent the Babylonians from invading. But the king is still required to practice justice. There may be passages in the Bible whose application to us changes in light of the context in which they were given. But there is never a time when it is not God's command to administer justice. But what does that mean? Well, let's have a look at what they might have understood as the requirements of justice. Jehoiakim's injustices are mentioned in Jeremiah 22 and 36, and also in 2 Kings 23. And we're told that he used forced labour without pay, and that he had no concern for widespread social injustice. But we're not told what those other injustices were. We know from elsewhere in the Bible that God has particular concern for orphans, widows, and aliens or foreigners. That group of people are mentioned repeatedly. And we know that certain actions are forbidden: murder, theft, and so on. But these things don't tell us the content of God's idea of administering justice. The Ten Commandments assume that we know what murder and theft are, and most of us assume that we know what they are too. But believe it or not, they're contested terms even now. Did you know that a person can be sentenced to life in jail for murder in this country, with the jury having accepted that they did not intend to kill? You can ask me about that afterwards if you'd like, but the definition of murder is wider, perhaps, than we might assume. The administration, then, of justice is more than just a list of laws, criminal or otherwise. For justice to be administered, we need commentary on what those laws mean and how those laws shall be applied in practice. Deuteronomy tells us about the appointment of judges, that they should be appointed in every town, and it says they shall judge fairly, without partiality and without accepting bribes. Even a rudimentary appeals structure is in place in Deuteronomy, where difficult cases are sent to the capital city to be dealt with. A sense of contempt of court is mentioned also in Deuteronomy. Provisions for witness testimony and the need for two or three witnesses is specified, with penalties for false testimony in line with the punishment for the crime being tried. God did not distinguish classes of people. Equality before the law was practiced, unlike some of the surrounding nations. It says, "And I charged your judges at that time, hear the disputes between your people and judge fairly, whether the case is between two Israelites or between an Israelite and a foreigner residing among you. For the capital crime of murder, it says there shall be safe refuges in three cities where an accused can be safe." I want us to imagine just for a moment being accused of murder in a society with no recognised police force, no state apparatus for investigating crimes, no jails. Jails protect the rest of us from violent criminals, don't they? But in a country without a justice system, a jail might be a very welcome refuge to a person wrongly accused and fearing justice at the hands of their neighbours. To practice justice, then, it seems there needs to be wider institutional apparatus, the administration of justice. But it's not just the criminal law and the administration of criminal law that matters to God. In Judah, being a theocracy, of course, there were no political rights, which we hold particularly dearly in democratic countries. But there was a whole slew of social rights, which, for some reason, we seem reluctant to embrace sometimes in this country. Finders keepers is not a principle known to God or indeed to the law in England and Wales. Lost items must be cared for and reasonable efforts made to repatriate them to their owner. The first health and safety laws are found in the Bible. God instructed the Israelites to look out for the physical safety of others on their premises. It says in Deuteronomy, when you build a house, make a parapet around your roof so that you may not bring the guilt of bloodshed on your house if someone falls from the roof. It was forbidden to withhold wages, which must be paid daily at the end of the day. That was one of Jehoiakim's sins, breaking early employment law. And the Bible distinguishes the slavery of forced labour from the form of indentured work that did at least look out for the indentured person's well-being. Again, in Deuteronomy it says, if a slave has taken refuge with you, do not hand them over to their master. Let them live among you wherever they like and in whatever town they choose. A rudimentary form of refugee law, perhaps. Also says in Deuteronomy, do not deprive the foreigner or the fatherless of justice. And as I said in an earlier place, it makes it clear that foreigners are to be treated in the same way as Israelites. It was not a crime in Israel to eat a handful of fruit or grain growing in another person's field, but it was forbidden to fill your basket with their crops. And finally, it also says in Deuteronomy that the fields must not be stripped bare at harvest time, but anything remaining after the first pass of the fields must be left for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. The Bible realistically indicates that there will always be poor people, but in Deuteronomy it says there need be no poor people among you. The first seeds of a welfare state seem to have been ordained by God, and the Bible is silent on whether the individual, foreigner, orphan, or widow, actually deserved such handouts. It simply instructs that the gleanings were to be left for them. Of course, Deuteronomy isn't all nice, and there are passages that challenge our modern democratic mindsets and assumptions. We no longer execute prisoners or practice corporal punishment. There are other instructions in Deuteronomy that we do not follow, and that's right. The UK isn't ancient Israel, it's not a theocracy, and it does have state institutions and apparatus that mean the more brutal forms of justice can be avoided. Those are contextual points that are matters of justice themselves, but maybe for a different sermon. What we're looking at for the moment is what God required for the administration of justice by the kings of Judah. What we can discern is this: the administration of justice required fair and unbiased judges, with rules of evidence to protect the accused, and with limits on the punishment that could be meted out. There were social laws about property, how to deal with lost and found items, how to treat employees, how to treat foreigners, and how to treat the poor and vulnerable. There is a difference between behaving justly towards others and administering justice, which was primarily the job of the king, i.e. the state. And the state still has the major role in administering justice, in setting in place the institutions for justice. And it has special powers that ordinary citizens don't have, to detain suspects and to punish and incarcerate the guilty. In a democracy, we have a greater role in holding the state accountable for its actions and opportunities to do so in a way that citizens in a theocracy, like ancient Judah, did not. But we also have a responsibility to administer justice in our church, towards one another and ourselves. Not in terms of judging each other, but in terms of treating each other justly and in having in place the structures to support that. I want to say a little bit more about that in a moment, but I want to address the issue of holding the state to account first, very briefly. And that's actually more important now in light of Brexit. Whatever its ills, the EU is at least constrained in its actions by the treaties agreed unanimously by the member states that make up the EU. In UK law, outside of the EU, there is no such constraint. Our Parliament, which is largely controlled by the governing party, can enact any law it likes. And so there is a greater responsibility on citizens, post-Brexit, to hold parliamentarians and government to account. I'm afraid it's hard to talk about justice without being a little bit political. Some very exaggerated claims were made by both sides in the run-up to the Brexit referendum, with the alleged invasion of immigrants being one particularly potent image. While I would challenge both that message and the image used to portray it, even if it were true, the injunction of God is to administer justice to both citizen and foreigner alike. But don't worry, I'm not about to turn this sermon into a political manifesto. There are plenty of things I could mention if I wanted to. But can I ask you, and this is going to be a repeated request, to pray deeply about some of the issues that I'm going to mention. So first, and I can't avoid it, how are we treating foreigners residing in the UK? EU citizens who are lawfully working and living here, whose immigration status is now uncertain pending the Brexit negotiations. Immigrants from other countries in this rapidly changing context where the immigration rules are being ever tightened. Can I remind you the way our partner missionaries were treated when they arrived in the UK when Annette was pregnant? So can I ask you to pray deeply about those matters? Closer to home and moving away from politics. A few weeks ago, Hazel and I attended a safeguarding course run by the Eastern Baptist Association. You might not be aware that the focus of safeguarding has been widened from just looking at the safety of children to include a significant element of looking after vulnerable adults. And we learnt that the definition of vulnerable adult is surprisingly wide. Vulnerability can arise out of many situations. I'm just going to mention a few that were suggested to us. So where a person experiences learning, sensory or physical disability, or old age and frailty, or mental health problems, or where English is not their first language, or where they have experienced past abuse or trauma, where they've experienced bereavement, illness, dementia or confusion, or where they experience addiction. That's a non-exhaustive list. There are other things that make us vulnerable. It was pointed out to us that we are all vulnerable adults at some point in our lives, because we all at some point experience illness, bereavement, or other traumas. How do we ensure that this church is a safe place for both children and vulnerable adults? How do we make it a place where their needs are catered for and where their vulnerabilities won't be exploited? How do we make this a place where people don't have to put on their Sunday face for fear of having to explain their sadness or their distress? We can't tell by looking at people the vulnerabilities that they might be carrying. Are there things that we can and should do to ensure that vulnerable people are safe here? This is something the leaders will be addressing much more closely in coming weeks. But again, can I ask you to pray deeply about this matter as we do so. Jesus said that we are to seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. I don't know if any of you remember, but Kathy, one of our partner missionaries, in one of her updates, told us that in the French translations of the Bible, the word righteousness is translated as justice. So it's seek first his kingdom and his justice. If I asked you, are you walking righteously? You might think in terms of personal morality, piety, obedience to God on an individual basis. If we asked ourselves, are we walking justly before God? I wonder how that response might change. I think it might dovetail with something of what Steve was talking about in the sermon at the start of the month, about being just both to other people and to ourselves. And it's that latter one that I'm going to focus on for the last few minutes. What does it mean to be just to ourselves? I want you to imagine for a moment that you're going through a tough period. Perhaps you don't have to imagine very hard. You're tired and you decide to take a few days off to recuperate. And it's at that point that a needy person makes themselves known. And you can imagine your days off evaporating as you tend to their needs. You might feel very well justified in doing so. Or instead, imagine you've just sat down for the evening with a good book and the phone rings and a friend is asking, what are you up to? And the word on the tip of your tongue is, well, nothing. But if you say that, you know you'll be putting your book down. Your evening relaxing won't happen. What do you say? Well, I'm sure we've all been in similar situations to those. I want to suggest that we have very little to offer others if we don't look after ourselves too. We can't administer justice to others if we're exhausted ourselves. Looking after ourselves is therefore a justice matter. And this counts for ministers, leaders, and all of us. How comfortable are we saying that we're busy and we can't help someone, when in fact we're planning to take that first opportunity in ages to sit at home and relax? Do we feel guilty for that? Well, we might well feel guilty and lazy, but I wonder how much of that comes out of cultural expectations to always need to appear to be doing something. Of course, laziness is an issue, and we need to be able to discern the difference between laziness and justifiable relaxation time. But I wonder how countercultural it would be if we felt able, confident enough to be honest and vulnerable with people about those times and say something like, I'm relaxing alone this evening at home. I've been busy. I need to recharge my batteries. Is that not what the church has been doing this past year in time for God? And it hasn't always been wholly comfortable, has it? Some of us have not found it easy to sit, to be still, and to be quiet for an hour before God. Some of us have not felt comfortable with the lack of activity going on in the church. And some have left. Looking after ourselves and looking after one another are justice matters, and they don't come free. There are vulnerable people in this church. Perhaps you are one of them. But I suggest that at some point in your life, you certainly will be. So again, can I ask you to pray deeply about these matters and about all the other matters that I've mentioned this morning? Ask God what it means to administer justice in each of those situations. Ask God what justice requires in each of them. I've got an opinion on some of those, but I'm not going to tell you what you should think or what you should do. That justice must be administered is not, I think, open to debate. I think that's been made fairly clear from the scripture. But the content of justice is inherently contestable. What people think is fair and just in a situation will differ. It goes back to the context again, and hence the call to pray. So pray and ask God if he requires anything of you in the area of justice, if he requires anything of us as a church in the area of justice, because there is never a time when it is not God's command to administer justice.